You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, there's a lot of confusion over how COVID-19 cases are recorded compared with the number of flu cases. We'll talk to a public health expert about how the numbers we see are compiled and what they mean. Now, not many of us go around restoring ruined temples or collecting ancient artifacts for fun anymore, but those were some of the activities of the earliest known hobbyists. Times have changed, the demands of our lives have changed too, and so have our hobbies. Right now, we have a lot of options out there, and whether we want it or not, a lot of people have some extra free time right now. And learning about hobbies of the past could add a little perspective to whatever project you might be chiseling away at now. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your hobby, and are you spending a lot of time on it these days? Again, call 800-642-1234. Amanda Foreman is a historian and author of several books, including her next book, The World Made by Women, A History of Women from the Apple to the Pill, out in 2021. She's a columnist at the Wall Street Journal with the biweekly Historically Speaking column and an honorary research senior fellow in the history department at the University of Liverpool. She wrote the recent column, Hobbies for Kings and the People, for the Wall Street Journal. Amanda, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, hobbies are common now. You write back, if we go back a few thousand years, not so much. What are our first signs that some people, maybe at the top of the social ladder, were having hobbies of their own?
Well, the very first sign that we have of somebody having a genuine hobby was actually a Babylonian king called Nabonidus, who is known in the Bible because he invaded Israel. Apart from that, he was a passionate antiquarian, and he would go around digging up ancient temples and restoring them. And in fact, he became so passionate about this hobby that he forgot to actually rule and do a good job governing Babylon. And so his own people rose up against him and invited the Persians in, who then took over Babylon, and that was the end of the Neo-Babylon dynasty.
That's, I guess, some good perspective for people who think they might be spending a little too much time on their hobbies these days. If they haven't given up their own empire, they're not doing so bad, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, you know, hobbies are immersive, and he was certainly just totally captivated. He loved the past, actually. He gave that love to his own daughter, who was called Enigalda Nana, and she actually created the world's first museum. Her father would restore these old temples, 2,000-year-old temples at this point. He lived in the 6th century BC, and he was interested in temples built by the Sumerians over 2,000 years before, and he would find them, and he would get them going again and rebuild them and have install a priest to have some kind of worship going on there. And then they'd find these artifacts, which his daughter would then restore and display in her palace with a little note saying this was found at the Temple of Ur and things like that.
And then advancing a little bit in history to the Roman Empire. Again, we're talking the wealthier Romans here. What kind of hobbies did they get into?
Well, it's really interesting because, like the Greeks, they had slaves, and therefore anything manual was frowned upon. So things like collecting gold coins was completely fine, and Caesar Augustus, the first Roman emperor, was an absolutely avid collector of gold coins in particular, especially Greek ones. And then he would give a few to friends as well, that is a kind of token of his esteem. But when they talked about things like, oh, gardening is my hobby, they didn't actually mean, you know, gardening, because that's what slaves did. But, you know, wandering around the garden, perhaps snipping a rose or, you know, deadheading one flower was a hobby enough.
I understand you've gotten into gardening yourself, but you're a little more hands-on with it than a Roman patrician might have been.
Yes, I am. I think that one of the reasons why gardening has really taken off in the 20th century is that as we all live increasingly indoors, unlike the Romans did, the need to reconnect with the outside and to feel the elements in our hands has become incredibly important to mental health, which, you know, for the Romans and their sunshine and their olive oil and all that, you know, just they didn't need it in the same way that we do in the post-industrial age.
We're talking to author and historian Amanda Foreman about the past and present of hobbies. She wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal, Hobbies for Kings and the People. Well, let's get to the people now, Amanda. When did hobbies become something for closer to everyone anyway?
Well, the printing press in the in the 15th century really changed everything, because once you can read, and once you can get hold of books, then reading becomes a hobby, for example. And then also you have manuals, which can spread knowledge. So chess playing starts to really take off. Music can be printed, and then more people can learn instruments. And so that's the first time that you start to see, in paintings, for example, people doing ordinary things that we would call hobbies, like playing an instrument. But even then, there was this incredible snobbery about how good you got at doing something. So unlike today, to be really proficient at your hobby, say playing an instrument, might make you seem like you were a minstrel, you know, and which would then put you with the servant class. So, you know, you could be good, but not too good.
Wow. Okay. Well, let's bring on a caller with a modern hobby now at 800-642-1234. Malachi is with us in Richfield. Malachi, hello.
Hi.
What's your hobby, Malachi?
I do 3D printing.
3D wow. printing. I've seen that in action. What kind of stuff do you do with that?
Well, lately I've been doing a lot more printing tools for seamstresses to make masks.
Okay, so taking advantage of this skill, and I assume equipment you have access to help people with the reaction to the COVID-19 outbreak?
Right, yeah, they're tape makers. They're just little tools that they can hold to help fold over fabric to make tape.
Cool. Malachi, thank you so much for calling in and sharing that. And Amanda, that's kind of why we wanted to talk about hobbies now. A lot of people are getting into or getting back into their hobbies. And some of them, especially the quilters and seamstresses and whatnot, have a very practical application these days. Can you talk about turning to our hobbies in a time of need?
Yes. Well, that really, for America, that really happened during the Great Depression, when suddenly millions of Americans were either, you know, unemployed or underemployed. And what were they going to do with their time? People had so much more time, and they needed to get purpose, needed to feel a sense of achievement, but it also needed to be inexpensive. And hobbies just took off exponentially, because it was a way of creating a schedule, meaning in a day, that had been otherwise, you know, taken away from them because they had no job. And that's when you start to see things not just like, you know, stamp collecting, but hobbies such as crafting, making, quilting, woodwork, the stuff that, you know, you has a beginning, middle, and end, and you can look at it and say, I did that, I made that. And that's something that came out in a similar time, really, you know, the Great Depression. And today, one of the things that we're seeing is mass joblessness and what you do with your time.
Malachi, thanks a lot for calling in and for the work you're doing. We're talking to Amanda Foreman, historian and author. She writes the Historically Speaking column for the Wall Street Journal. We're talking about the past and present of hobbies. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been able to take up or maybe revisit a hobby during this time? What inspired your hobby choice? Where did you learn how to do it? Did somebody teach you? Share your story at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about hobbies with Amanda Foreman, historian and author. We're talking about her piece in the Wall Street Journal about the history of hobbies. And you can join in with your own hobby story at 800-642-1234. Whether you've revisited or taken up a new hobby thanks to the pandemic, or if you've been long practicing your hobbies, tell us what it is you do and maybe how and why you got started. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Nura went onto Facebook. She tells us, I knit, crochet, sew, listen to podcasts, and recently bought a vertical garden. My mom and auntie taught me how to crochet. My mom taught me how to sew. My parents, auntie and uncle, and great-grandparents did gardening, so I learned from them. My dear high school friend taught me how to knit in exchange for me teaching her how to crochet. So I love that the generational perspective there being handed down from person to person. Amanda, hobbies don't have to be solitary. We can share them with family and friends.
That's so true. And that's been one of the great innovations that's come with the internet, that as schools stopped teaching skills such as cooking and needlework and woodwork and craft making in general, YouTube took over, where if you didn't know how to do something, you would find somebody doing it on YouTube and they would give you a 10-minute masterclass. You want to make pasta? Go on YouTube. Someone will show you how to do that. Want to learn how to knit? Watch somebody. They'll show you how to do it on YouTube. So that's been one of the great modern innovations that did not exist in history, where you had to learn all your skills from your mother or your father, or you ended up being without skills.
It's a way to learn those skills, and then also people can share them either by selling them online at the Etsy websites or other things like that, or just for fun and free. It's a way, we have lots of ways now to show the outcome of our work with other people.
Yeah, that's right. And it's much more meaningful than, say, what the Victorians did, where they really got into hobbies in a big way. The Industrial Revolution created a lot more time for a lot more people. There are just many more things to do and collect and make. But they had some pretty strange notions about what was worthwhile. So, for example, the Victorians loved taxidermy, stuffing dead animals, but they're not just, you know, putting the head of a fox on a board and then putting it on the wall. They liked to stuff animals in human poses. So dancing mice was really popular, ice skating hedgehogs, rats playing cards, dancing cats, that kind of thing was just huge.
I don't think I'm going to take that one up myself, but more power to the Victorians. I do want to go back to our callers, though. James is with us in Northbrook, Illinois. James, hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
What do you want to tell us about, James?
Oh, well, I got two hobbies. I reactivated my glass insulator hobby, which is a very limited hobby. Not a whole lot of people into it, but I collect those glass. They're all different kinds and types, and they have swirls, and they have a beauty to it, and they're on the old telephone poles. And I all brought out my Lionel train set, and I have a really nice setup, so I have a lot to do on that. But I am actually working. I have a lot of projects I'm working on. But I kind of reactivated this because I don't have as much contact with a lot of my friends that I used to, except on the internet.
Well, James, thanks for making contact with us and sharing that. So the train set, and then he mentioned these glass insulators, these parts on telephone poles. I know a lot of people in the industrial era, Amanda, or in recent years, they'll collect things like gears or, you know, pictures of rusting factories or things like that. There's a lot of fun ways to collect stuff that people might not think of as artistic objects in the first place.
That's so true. Also taking photographs of derelict asylums or grand houses or empty schools and hospitals. That's also another very popular hobby nowadays. One of the hobbies that I've learned recently is getting an uptick in popularity is collecting toy soldiers to recreate battle scenes. And interestingly enough, the first person to really popularize that as a hobby was the science fiction writer H.G. Wells, who wrote War of the Worlds, which eventually has been turned into lots of movies, including one starring Tom Cruise. And he would recreate these huge battle scenes, both battle scenes from the Civil War here in the U.S., as well as from the Napoleonic War in Europe. And he would invite friends over to smash and blow up the various soldiers, you know, to recreate well-known battles.
Thanks a lot for that comment. We'll go to Dennis now in Racine. Dennis, hello.
Hello. I love to take photographs with this ordinary small camera. It's easy to do, but I'm not a good photographer, but it is something that costs what costs, but then you can assemble them into large print albums. The result is going to be stunning.
Dennis, thank you so much. And even if you're not a good photographer, I can just about guarantee you're a better photographer than I am. And Dennis brings up a good point, Amanda. We don't necessarily have to be good at our hobby to get enjoyment from it.
No, that's absolutely right. Winston Churchill, Prime Minister of England during the World War II, took up painting in his 40s. He said that it actually rescued him from a very deep depression when his career was seemingly tanking, and he thought that he would never be in politics ever again. This is before he became prime minister. And he was never a good painter, and, you know, that's something that he himself freely admitted. But it didn't matter, because it not only did it save him mentally, it gave him the greatest enjoyment. And nowadays people collect his work because they see something of the great man's personality in those paintings, which are so full of life and they're really vivid.
In our last few moments, Amanda, are you taking a renewed joy given the trouble in the world right now with your gardening hobby?
Yes, I am. I sometimes feel that if I'd had a previous life, I would have been a gardener. But you know what? Like many, many other Americans, I'm also taking up baking. The banana bread is the most looked up recipe in Google right now.
I believe it. Amanda, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you for having me. Take care. Stay safe.
You too. That was Amanda Foreman, a historian and author of several books, including her forthcoming book, The World Made by Women, A History of Women from the Apple to the Pill, out in 2021. She writes the Historically Speaking column for The Wall Street Journal. She's an honorary research senior fellow in the history department at the University of Liverpool. You can still weigh in on the conversation we just had about hobbies. Let us know about your hobby, if you're getting into it for the first time or getting back into it, where it came from, who you learned it from, and what you get out of it. Share some pictures, too. We've got some rag rugs there from one of our listeners, Linda, that she's been making. That looks pretty cool. I'm looking at a picture right now. Again, share yours over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret with Kate Archer Kent. In response to the uncertainty caused by COVID-19, today is Giving Tuesday Now, a global day of support for the organizations that make a difference in our communities.
Join the movement with your gift to WPR at 888-202-2552 or WPR.org. Your generosity keeps us connected with essential news, thought-provoking conversations, and inspiring music.
It's a great time to give because right now we have a dollar-for-dollar match. This generous Giving Tuesday Now match is from current members. It means they'll double every dollar we receive, up to $25,000.
It is their way of encouraging you to join them in supporting Wisconsin Public Radio. So double your support right now at 888-202-2552 or WPR.org.
There are so many organizations that are providing important services at this time. You turn to WPR for news coverage that's independent and follows the highest standards of journalism.
The quality that you rely on is possible thanks to you. It's listener support that makes up the largest piece of funding for WPR programs. So make a difference right now with your gift at 888-202-2552 or WPR.org.
You're part of WPR's community of listeners. Now join our community of members, people who support the programs they value. Become a member with your gift of, say, $10 a month or $120.
More than 50,000 individuals and families donate to make up the largest piece of our funding. Your support of any amount really makes a difference. It all starts with your gift at 888-202-2552 or WPR.org.
If you've already made a donation this year or you're a sustaining member making ongoing monthly gifts, thank you so much.
Consider making an extra gift of, say, $50 or $100 at 888-202-2552. 2552 or WPR.org. And thank you so much for your extra support this Giving Tuesday. Now, your gift powers the stories. It powers the programs that keep you connected to the world.
We have a special Giving Tuesday Now dollar for dollar match in effect up to $25,000.
And current members have joined together to inspire you to support Wisconsin Public Radio today. So double the impact of your gift at 888-202-2552 or WPR.org.
Wisconsin Public Radio is your window to the world. WPR and NPR have a team of experienced reporters here in our state and around the globe to keep you connected with news. In these difficult times, they find the stories about science, policy and economics that you need to know, and also the stories that bring a smile to your face.
Listeners' support makes this indispensable public service available to everyone. So be part of the team. Give at 888-202-2552 or WPR.org and fund the news, the talk, and the music you rely on.
Our Giving Tuesday Now dollar for dollar match is still in effect. Your gift at 888-202-2552 or WPR.org is going to go twice as far.
As the complex story of the coronavirus continues to unfold, you can count on WPR for trustworthy news, for the conversations that help you understand our new reality, and the music and entertainment that provide a much-needed respite. Wisconsinites are relying on WPR more than ever, and it is your support at 888-202-2552 or WPR.org that makes it possible.
We've heard from a lot of listeners who are finding WPR more important now than ever. Jeannie from Monona said, "We value WPR for the solid, responsible, and truthful reporting at the national, state, and local levels, mixed with the right balance of arts, culture, and human life. Combined, they make my day complete." Thank you, Jeannie.
Yes, indeed. Your gift right now, so important. It makes the news, the conversations, and the music available to everyone in Wisconsin. Join the Giving Tuesday Now movement with your gift at 888-202-2552 or WPR.org. And thank you so much.
Coming up, we'll discuss the differences in reported flu cases and COVID-19 cases and why there's confusion over the dangers of both illnesses. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on the morning show, get a preview of a special congressional election this month in Wisconsin's big 7th district. That's tomorrow at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, according to Johns Hopkins University, there have been more than 70,000 confirmed COVID-19 deaths in the United States since they started tracking the illness. And according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, there were an estimated 24,000 to 62,000 flu-related deaths in the U.S. during the 2019 to 2020 season. That ran from October of last year to early April. While the number of deaths attributed to the flu is significant, it doesn't tell the full story. And when we try to compare that number to the number of COVID-19 deaths, that story gets even more confusing. At issue is how these deaths are recorded and how they're reported publicly. Our next guest joins us to help clarify these numbers and tell us what, if anything, we can learn from them. Dr. Jonathan Tempty is the Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He's also chair of the Wisconsin Council on Immunization Practices. Dr. Tempty, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thank you very much, Rob. It's great to be with you again.
Well, a lot of people in the public eye have made comparisons about the death toll of COVID-19 versus annual flu deaths. And I know in my own head and probably a lot of other people, to try to get a sense of the scope of COVID-19, I'm comparing those two numbers. But the more I look at it, the more it isn't really an apples to apples comparison. Can you talk about how we record deaths from both causes and why they might be a little different?
Absolutely. This is an area of a lot of confusion because it is very nebulous. for the COVID-19, this is something we're doing a great deal of testing for right now. When somebody is hospitalized, we're doing testing. And when they die, we know that there is laboratory confirmation. And as we heard on the news break, we have now recorded 353 deaths in Wisconsin, and actually 13 of those reported just today. That compares to laboratory-confirmed influenza deaths in Wisconsin for the entirety of this past year, basically from October through April, of 167. But the challenge comes in, who do you test and who do you have that confirmation on? And that's where we end up entirely relying on projections and estimations for influenza, not only here in Wisconsin, but across the country.
So we know that with influenza here, we know that we have a certain number of people who were tested and died from it, but public health experts are pretty sure that a lot more people may have died as a result of flu or related complications who didn't get tested, who didn't get confirmed. So we have to do some statistical work to get a ballpark of how many that is. Is that right, about right?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. In the United States, the only reportable death from influenza are for pediatric cases, so for children age 18 and or age 17 and under. There's a requirement by law for states to report those cases onto the CDC and also for physicians to report those cases to the state. But otherwise, everything is largely the realm of guesswork.
And then with COVID-19, as you're saying, this is when we hear these numbers, they are test-confirmed deaths, or I understand sometimes clinical evaluations of deaths that match up really well with COVID-19. So these are more precise counts? Is that a fair way to say that?
I think that's fair. Precise in that there is a standard methodology. We still think we're probably missing a number of COVID-19 deaths because there are people who are still dying of things that look like pneumonia or neurological things or heart attacks and so on. And many of these deaths may be attributable to COVID-19, but we just don't have that hard data. So what we're seeing right now, for example, in the 353 deaths, those are all either confirmed by laboratory or having a very, very good case description so we can attribute it in that way. On the flip side, with influenza, during the cold and flu season, we see a lot of people, particularly elders, being admitted to the hospital with congestive heart failure, with respiratory problems, with pneumonias. And unfortunately, the standard is that many of those patients are never tested for any specific virus, including influenza. And so they can go on, possibly recover, or they may go on and die. And we don't really know what caused that death.
Talking to Dr. Jonathan Temte from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at how we evaluate the impact, especially in this case, the impact on the death rate here in the United States of influenza versus COVID-19. It's harder to compare and contrast the numbers that we might think, that I might have thought. Dr. Temte, there are arguments out there that say, hey, these CDC numbers or the Johns Hopkins numbers or state-by-state numbers are overstating COVID-19. People saying things that are an unrelated, say, pneumonia case are now being clocked as COVID-19 fatalities. What do you make of that argument?
Well, basically, I just don't buy that. I have to admit, one of the most frightening graphics I've seen in the last couple of weeks comes from CDC. And every week, they report the percent of deaths in the United States that are due to pneumonia or influenza. And over the last 2 months, they've also added in COVID-19. And so if you can think of a period over a long time, when you look at each week and ask the question, how many people this week died of influenza or pneumonia? If you plot that out over time, it goes up and down, more deaths in the wintertime, less deaths in the summertime. And we can use kind of the undulating percentage as an indicator of influenza. And if we go all the way back to 2009 and 2010, when we had the influenza pandemic, this percentage jumped up all the way to a frightening 8.1%, meaning that basically during the worst week, 1 in 12 people in the United States died of what looked like either influenza or pneumonia. And going a little bit further forward, 2017-18, we had a really, really bad influenza year, and it peaked out at 10.1%, okay? So about 1 in 10 people dying during that worst week died of influenza pneumonia. Fast forward to the week ending April 11th this year, it hit a record of 23.5%. I've never seen it look that bad. That means that about 1 out of every 4 people in the United States that died that week died of influenza or pneumonia or COVID-19. And influenza was not circulating at that time. It had largely gone away. So the people who dismiss COVID-19 as being something that is hyperinflated or being hyped too much are unfortunately totally wrong. This is a real phenomenon. It's a scary disease. And the more we learn about it, the more frightening I think it becomes.
We're talking to Dr. Jonathan Tempty. He's the Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He's with us to talk about how flu cases are recorded compared to COVID-19 cases, what that means for public health, and we'll look a little bit at public health efforts to slow the spread of the novel coronavirus. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about influenza and COVID-19 case numbers? What are you still curious about when it comes to COVID-19, the disease, and the novel coronavirus that causes it? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about how the CDC records flu cases compared with COVID-19 cases and wider issues about the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. Dr. Jonathan Tempty is with us, Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the topic? What do you feel like you need more clarity on? What is confusing to you? There's a lot confusing about what's going on right now. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Steve is with us in Chautauqua. Steve, hello.
Hello. Hello. I want to thank the doctor for coming on, because probably for the past couple of weeks, this is all I've been thinking about. As a healthcare provider, I think, you know, this COVID virus has probably been here since probably November, and, you know, we've never tested for it, and we have people that are dying, certainly of congestive heart failure and flu, you know, that really skews the numbers to some extent. I just would like to know if he agrees a little bit that this could have been here in November and December, and the deaths around the country from flu-like symptoms could have been COVID, and we just didn't know it.
Thanks for the call, Steve. Now, I've seen in France they retested some samples and found at least some cases earlier of COVID-19 than they had expected to find. One death in the U.S. was a couple of weeks earlier than we expected. Dr. Tempty, I don't know if I've seen anything. Maybe you have, talking about like November or December in the U.S.
Well, it's an excellent question, Steve. I think the evidence we have is that this made its way across the Pacific Ocean more like in early January to mid-January. We don't see much evidence for any spread before that. There are some efforts going forward to try and look at archival specimens, so specimens that were taken from individuals and put into deep freeze. So there's some ongoing work on that. But the other way to look at it is there has been a lot of work looking at the genomic sequencing of these viruses. And by looking at that, you can get an idea of the rate of mutation, where things are going. And it looks at like much of the virus right now that is circulating across the United States is actually been dominated more by the viruses that came through Europe and then made its way to the United States. So it's still an open book, but I think, to be honest, November is probably too early, possible December, but more likely the first cases in January.
Thanks a lot for that call. Dr. Tempty, I want to talk about our public health efforts here in the United States. The fear early on was we'd have exponential growth, a spread of the novel coronavirus, worries about it overwhelming hospitals and other healthcare facilities. We've had stay-at-home orders of one sort or another in many states. We seem to have avoided that worst case, and now we're hearing arguments from the people who support it saying that shows this worked. We managed to keep the numbers down. Other people saying, look, the numbers are lower than expected. That proves we didn't need that. We can't run back the clock and do an experiment a different way. So how do you evaluate those two dueling claims?
Well, again, wonderful question. And in fact, I'm just looking at a graphic right now on my computer screen. And in fact, for the United States, we were in a full-blown exponential rise from about the beginning of March until about two-thirds of the way through March. And then we started seeing things taper off. If you can recall, March 18th in Wisconsin, we had a statewide closure of our schools and followed by a week by the stay-at-home executive order. And these things are what we have from a public health standpoint to effectively curtail transmission. So I would argue from everything I know about epidemiology of respiratory viruses and the studies I've been doing over the last 20 years that we see some beautiful evidence of the social distancing and the other public health initiatives having a tremendous effect and helping to limit the number of cases and, more importantly, limiting the number of deaths.
Let's bring on another caller now. Chris is with us in Fontana. Chris, hello.
Hello.
What do you want to bring up, Chris?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I pick up my prescriptions at a pharmacy in southeastern Wisconsin, and when I responded to a call to pick up my prescription, I was greeted at the door by someone who asked if I'd been recently exposed to somebody with COVID-19. And I said, yes, I was around a person who was that night, in fact, tested positive for COVID-19. And they took my name and my phone number at the door of the pharmacy. And I wondered, what are they using that for? Are they tracking people that have been exposed to COVID-19 or have tested positive, or what is the deal with that?
Chris, thanks for the call. Dr. Tempty, it sounds like contact tracing, but I don't know what's actually happening in the state right now.
Yeah, I'm not sure about this particular case because connection between Walgreens and public health is not there at this point in time. So I'm not sure on the specifics for your particular situation there. A broader subject is that of widespread testing and contact tracing. And that implies that if a person is tested and they turn positive, public health will be in contact with that person, ask who may you have been around for prolonged periods of time over the period of time that we think you were contagious. And from there, you build upon and look for those individuals, offer voluntary testing. And by doing so, what you attempt to do is get on top of an outbreak. This is going to become more and more important as we have flattened this curve, and hopefully we see the number of cases going down. If you can jump on top of cases early on, identify them, identify contacts, do the second round of testing, you can better identify where things are spreading and how to contain them.
Thanks for that call. And Dr. Tempty, thanks so much for joining us again today.
Well, it has been my pleasure. Keep safe and keep doing good things.
That's Dr. Jonathan Tempty, Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He joined us today to talk about how flu cases are estimated and reported by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, how that compares and in some ways doesn't compare with the way COVID-19 cases are recorded. The Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development estimates more than 700,000 residents could find themselves suddenly unemployed amid the COVID-19 pandemic. Rich Kramer talked with some newly unemployed Wisconsinites about how they're coping.
Inside Madison's Alliant Energy Center, around a dozen employees with the Second Harvest Food Bank of Southern Wisconsin busily fill boxes with dry goods and canned vegetables. The temporary location was offered by Dane County so workers could maintain proper distance from each other amid the COVID-19 pandemic. CEO Michelle Orge says they've already seen a 50% jump in the number of people seeking food since mid-March when they started offering boxes for pickup.
We previously would distribute about 40,000 pounds a day as an average throughout our 16 counties, and we have days of 80 to 100,000 pounds.
The Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development estimates the state's unemployment rate could reach nearly 27%. If that holds true, it would top unemployment figures from the Great Depression. Holly Myers is usually a full-time hairdresser at Love and Light Hairdressing in Madison. She has been out of work for more than a month now. She says that and the sudden changes to everyday life left her feeling
like a zombie.
Before the salon closed in late March, Myers said she was feeling nervous about being in direct contact with clients as the number of COVID-19 cases in Madison grew. Myers applied for unemployment insurance on March 23rd and got her first payment of $314 on April 11th. She says she hasn't seen the additional $600 per week promised by the federal stimulus bill.
Honestly, these are the things that we have to think about right now is what can I not pay and what can I pay? And it's taken a while for even like utilities and government to kind of come in and be like, hey, here are some resources or here are some ideas.
In the Chippewa County town of Tilden, Jillian Lee worked as a server and bartender until COVID-19 upended her life. She says at first she didn't expect the pandemic to impact rural Wisconsin, but that changed when Governor Tony Evers issued his Safer at Home order on March 25th.
I mean, it was a lot of rereading and reading and reading emails and, you know, shaking our heads and pretty much saying, well, you know, shoot, what are we going to do now?
Lee says her partner worked as an auto mechanic until he was laid off when business dried up last month. She says he spent 4 weeks negotiating an overloaded state unemployment system before getting his first payment. In the meantime, Lee says they've lived off of savings they've been building for years.
We're terrified that we're not going to be able to buy a house because that, you know, the down payment that we have saved for a house right now is all we've got, pretty much, you know.
For Jana Plotkin of Milwaukee, the news that her employer would shut down on March 16th was almost a relief. She's pursuing certifications in forensic science at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and was working as a server at Water Street Brewery. She says she also takes medication for Crohn's disease that leaves her more susceptible to viral infections.
I'm immune compromised. So when I heard about the virus and also as, you know, having a strong science background, I'm almost too informed on some of these things. So I started getting nervous for my own health.
Plotkin filed for unemployment online and got her first payment in about a month. Her boyfriend is still working, so they're doing okay, but money is definitely tight. She says she's a little jealous of his near-normal schedule.
I miss that. I miss the normalcy of being busy and having a purpose, an everyday purpose. That's the thing I miss the most.
Governor Evers has begun lifting restrictions on some businesses, allowing for things like curbside pickups and drop-off, games of golf, and pet grooming. Bars and restaurants are still only open for to-go food orders. Salons remain closed entirely. It's unclear how quickly the state will reopen and how long it will take businesses to bounce back when it does. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll round up some of the top stories in national politics, including the latest in the presidential race and news from the U.S. Senate, which is back in session this week. Also, we'll meet Wisconsin school students who are using their Learn at Home time to create newspapers. and keep watching the skies. A Wisconsin astronomer joins us for a look at the nighttime highlights for the next few months here in the state. You can get us started over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Are you a stargazer, amateur, professional, or just like to look up at stuff and not recognize what's going on up there, like me? Let us know over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 6, it can be tough to balance the demands of work and home life in normal times. And with layoffs, furloughs, working at home, schooling at home, there are whole new challenges. Kate's guest shares some advice, and you can join in with your experiences and ideas. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then a dietitian tells us how we could build a healthier relationship with the food we eat and get rid of some of the shame and negativity that can surround our food habits. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.